Yes, for those who didn't hear me say, I am in Kelseyville, which is in Lake County, and I'm putting in the website of the center where I am. It's called A Positive Light. It's founded by Joni Lane, who is in one of the squares. I'm out in the meditation building, and she's in the house with the dogs so that they won't bark while we're meditating. And thank you, Joni, for having me here and us here. So we'll begin with a 20-minute sit, and I'll give some guidance for the sit, and then I'll let you have some quiet as well. So settling into your posture here. Meditation, posture, whatever is most useful for you. And you can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. And just feeling how you're holding your body. Letting the body relax, soften. A sense of arriving. Of really being in the space where you are. Aware of your surroundings, aware of any sounds. When we practice remotely like this, we don't share a sonic environment, so each of us can work with the sounds or lack of sounds that are present. Feeling the body breathing. Seeing what feelings are present right now. What energies are moving through the body. Moods. And again, just arriving, acknowledging what is present, not trying to control that or judge that, just opening the awareness. For this felt level. And then letting the breath become a more focal point, bringing that into the foreground. Even as you allow awareness of body or sounds, feelings. We can think of it as a field of awareness. the senses, the mental experience, thoughts, and the breath is the foreground of that field. And in this mindfulness, this attentive state, trying to balance an attitude of ease, just allowing, with an engaged awareness. So while it's a relaxed state, it's not a dull or sleepy state. But finding this balance is one of the keys to our practice. To be present without striving, grasping, struggling. There's an attitude of kindness we bring to this practice. Kindness toward ourselves, kindness towards whatever arises in the heart or mind. None. Ill will, non-contention. A welcoming. All right. There's a nice big bell here. You see it? Yeah, there it is. All right. So welcome again. Friday night Zoom. We were talking at dinner before about emotions as energy, and this was something that it's kind of a topic that I talk about a lot, particularly in relation to meditation, as to sort of tune into feelings and emotions on this nonverbal level, and just sort of to sense them, and how revealing that can be. You know, what my experience and my sense is that of my less sort of developed awareness when I started to think about emotions as a teenager, that I quickly kind of labeled them and reified them, so that whenever certain feelings would appear then over the following decades, I kind of just slap this label on them, and that label would have, you know, it would have meaning that was disturbing, so that instead of just feeling something, there was a story that went along with it, and it might not be a real narrative story, but the meaning that it was a bad feeling, and that there was something wrong with me for having it, or that I needed to get rid of it, or I shouldn't have it. That then created like this, as I talk about, like a feedback loop, where when you have a negative thought about a difficult feeling, it triggers more difficult feelings, and then sort of becomes this cycle that, as I sort of sense it, or sort of my understanding of it is, in a way, something that's sort of a discrete experience becomes this global view and global experience, where it seems like I'm consumed with the feelings, rather than just, oh, feelings come up and then they change and I'm in another mood. Rather, it's like this difficult feeling comes up, and because of this unwholesome relationship with it and meaning that I put on it, it starts to take over my consciousness, so that, you know, I'm feeling it in my body. My thoughts are all oriented around it in a negative way. There's this painful emotional state, and then a sense that I have to solve it, or that I have to keep thinking about it, so that at a certain point, it just starts to define my reality. You know, one of the things about feelings, and again, like one of my themes, is that when you're having a certain feeling, it's like that the way the mind works is that when you're having a particular feeling, other times when you've had that feeling come to mind. So you tend to remember things that are similar to what you're experiencing now. And that's a survival mechanism, right? It's meant to be something that in evolution was like, oh, I remember this situation. I know how to deal with this. I've dealt with this before. But when it's turned into this kind of perverse feedback loop, a negative feedback loop, instead, it starts to seem like, oh yeah, this is how I always feel. You know? And then, of course, that gets projected out into the future. Oh, I'm going to keep feeling this. And then that gets fed by fear, because I don't want to be feeling this, but I'm going to be. So this is terrible. Like, my future is bad, my past is bad, and my present is bad. And it becomes this viewpoint. And so this idea of trying to drop and step out of, first of all, kind of step out of that whole loop, that whole feedback loop, into something more primal, more essential. That's just, and this is what mindfulness encourages us to do with everything. What am I feeling? And when we say, what am I feeling? That doesn't mean, what is the name of the thing that I'm feeling? It means, what are the qualities of the feeling that I'm having? And so it's one of the things that's always intrigued me about the way the Buddha talks about feeling, is that he doesn't put these kinds of labels on a lot of emotions. He mostly talks about things as having physical components and having sort of energetic, you know, components. It's pleasant, it's unpleasant. But he doesn't sort of put this much meaning on it. And for a long time, I was frustrated about that. I wanted to find something in the Buddhist canon that would help me to deal with these difficult emotions. And, you know, and really, I went so far as to, you know, to ask, you know, authorities on the early texts, like, why doesn't the Buddha talk about like depression, you know, or anxiety? And that it was, no one ever really gave me an answer, but I've come up with my own answer, the best, which is that he was seeing these feelings on a more essential level that wasn't colored with this narrative or this story. Now, he does talk about ill will, anger, and he does talk about grief. But these more complex emotions that are more constructions, no, he doesn't talk. I don't see him talking about that. So I think that what I've come to infer from that is that really this is what I'm getting at, is what he probably was doing with when working with emotions. And so it, the question comes then, well, what does that mean? How do I actually do that? And I was reminded this week of a text that I used to often read from, and it just sort of dropped off my radar in terms of using it, but I thought I would pull it out again tonight. And it's from Ajahn Amaro, and this is an early book of his. It's called Silent Rain. And I'm pretty sure you can find this on one of the monastery websites, that as an ebook that you could just download for free. And oddly, I don't remember how I first found this particular passage, because it's the very last chapter of the book. And with most Dharma books, I never get to the last chapter. I don't know if that's, other people find that too. You know, you kind of, you get into it for a while, and then it sort of sits on your nightstand. You're like, oh, I should get back to that. But you've gotten distracted. You're into reading something else. But anyway, I did discover this quite a while ago, years ago, maybe as long as 15 years ago or longer, and the chapter is called Absolute Zero, and says it's from a talk given on the Easter retreat at Amaravati Monastery in 1992. it's old. And it starts out by just sort of talking about mindfulness and what it is. Says much of our attention is normally taken up with the state of the world. In a retreat, we become more concerned with our own inner lives, and our own being. But outside a very specialized learning situation like this, our concern goes to the world around us. We see the struggle, the stress and difficulty inhibiting our own and other people's lives. So we try to do the right thing. We try to do what we can to help. It's the natural outcome of our meditation. We use Buddhist teachings exactly for this purpose. Even though our work may be done in a fairly enclosed, specialized environment, the aim of it is to understand the world internally and externally and to be able to help transform it. And then he starts to talk about mindfulness. The process of understanding depends on mindfulness, on the act of attention. It is best described by the Buddha as being a gradation of qualities. First of all, we need to simply apprehend what is going on, or have sati, mindfulness. As the mind apprehends, then that develops into comprehension, mindfulness and clear comprehension. In Pali, this is called sati sampajana, which means mindfulness not just of an object, but of the context within which it appears. So, and this then leads to wisdom. So this is kind of setting up this topic. And I'll just say that this term sati sampajana, mindfulness and clear comprehension, is a term that Ajahn Sumedho uses a great deal. And Ajahn Amaro was a student of Ajahn Sumedho. So he goes on to say this process is thus describing the transition from a mind which simply cognizes, which is a worldly quality with nothing to do with anything virtuous or unvirtuous, into knowing with a sense of comprehension and meaning. Then when we talk about being the one who knows, that's a quote, and that's what Ajahn Chah would say, the Buddha is the one who knows. This means there is the quality of wisdom, true illumination, and profound understanding there. So here we come to the piece that I was really thinking of. There are many practical applications of this. One of the most helpful is when dealing with different emotional states, feelings of intense pleasure or pain, restlessness, grief, hope or regret, anger or jealousy, feelings of warmth and comfort, affirmations and delight, whatever the emotion might be. Every emotion has a physical attribute to it. When we try to understand the emotions intellectually, or we try to unravel their causes analytically, just using our brain, we are looking in the wrong place. For an Asian person, when you talk about the mind, you point to your heart, not to your head. So we approach the understanding of emotional states not so much through the intellect as through the realm of feeling. When we notice we are in a particular mood of anxiety or excitement, energy, laziness, restlessness, or nameless dukkha, our old friend, where we know we are suffering, but can't quite figure out what it is we're suffering about, that feeling, rather than trying to analyze the emotion, we just bring it into our attention in the body. We use body consciousness as a way of bringing mindfulness to that feeling. What does anger feel like? What does resentment feel like? Know it directly and feel it in the body. In many ways, this bypasses the processes of entanglement that we create, because when we bring our attention into physical feelings, we can't buy into them in the same way. We feel the imbalance that attachment to the emotional state causes. So, you know, when I hear that, or when I read that, I think about that moment when I just notice that my mind is wandering, or I'm stirred up when I'm meditating, and how just instinctively and organically I let go. You know, it's like I'm sitting and I'm like, all of a sudden, like, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh, what am I doing? And I let go and I come back the breath and back into the body. We feel the imbalance that attachment to the emotional state causes. And so we're tuning in on that level, and we don't have to, you know, oh, what do I do with that? It's just like, it's just a natural thing to like, oh, let me step out of that. This is a tremendously useful way of training the mind to de-emphasize the intellectualizing process, the attempt to solve our problems just by thinking about them. Often, even if we have solved the problem in our brain, if we were worried about something and with logic have removed the source of the worry, the body can still be filled with tension and anxiety. It is charged up to worry about something. So we just finish one worry, but since the body is all set to keep going, it causes the brain to cook up another one. It finds something else to worry about. Since the body is tense and agitated, it can cause the merest thought to turn into a major problem. So this is, again, such a critical idea. My experience of this, and what somewhat explains this, is that thoughts are more transitory. They come and they go more quickly. So you can think something and then be like, oh, I got that figured out. But feelings in the body stay in the body longer. And there's probably a chemical reason for this. You know, you brain science people, you know, your cortisol doesn't flush out as soon as you just notice that your mind is wandering. So like he says, you solve it. Okay, I understand why I'm upset. All right, I'm going to let that go. But your body is still there. Your body is still activated, you know. And so if we don't hang out with that, if we don't stay with that feeling, just on that feeling level, as he says, we'll just get like, yeah, but, and then we'll go off. So he continues, if we bring attention to the body and contemplate, what is worry like? Where does it sit in the body? We can feel it like a knot of tension in the solar plexus in our gut. Every time you find your mind worrying about something, bring your attention down to your stomach. And worrying is just one of the things. Every time you find your mind doing anything, bring your attention down to your stomach, your solar plexus, and notice how it feels. Then just let it relax. Take your attention off the thing you are worrying about. Let your stomach soften and notice the effect it has upon the mind. So that's, you know, many of you, I'm sure, have heard the meditation instruction to just soften the belly. And there's even a practice called the soft belly meditation. It is a mysterious and magical thing, but suddenly it seems to be much less of a problem. The situation might still be there, but we are not so upset about it. We see it more clearly. This process opens us up to that spaciousness, which is beyond the feeling. So it's interesting that Ajahn Amaro concludes that section with this idea of sort of opening, and he sort of opens another door without really explaining what that door, you know, what is in the room that he's opening the door to. Need water. So let me just go back to that one more time. It is a mysterious and magical thing, but suddenly it seems to be much less of a problem, the thing that was on our mind. The situation might still be there, but we are not so upset about it. We see it more clearly. This process opens us up to that spaciousness, which is beyond the feeling. So I find that really, really intriguing. There have been times when I've actually resisted reading that last line if I was doing a teaching, because it kind of like, oh, wait, as I say, it opens up this other topic. But we have a little time, so I will explore it a little bit. And so what I think he's getting at, and this is, you know, based on knowing Ajahn Amaro and his kind of focus as a practitioner and as a teacher, is that as we get into the more and more subtle, and again, I think primal is how I think of it, level of awareness, you know, we're going here into this just gut level. Oh, this is, and what I call energetic level, feeling just as this raw experience, unnamed, you know, taken out of any context of our life or memory or psychology. Just, I'm just with this raw feeling. And when we drop into that, the next place that's available to us, the next possibility, like what's behind that, in other words, so in a way we're kind of drilling down, what's behind that then is raw, is pure awareness, is just knowing. So we're you know, if we think of our cognitive experience as it's sort of highest expression, most complex expression of the human mind, is, you know, verbalized thought, you know, thought that shows up as words, and as we say, stories, think interconnected, you know, constructions that we see as having meaning, and we see them as being connected to a self and a history. So the thoughts always have something to do with time, because there's the thoughts come out of the past, out of memory, and project out into the future. And so this is like the, you know, the where the human mind is so powerful, that it can do this. It can manufacture a world. It can dream up a building, or dream up you know, artificial intelligence. The amazing things that our consciousness, evolved brain can do. But meditation practice is actually, in a way, going back in evolution. So it goes back first to, okay, I'm going to step out of this thought place and just be in a body, right? So that's more like an animal, right? An animal that can't project and create the future, the past, and, you know, is just here. And so in that state of just being with the body, my consciousness now is stepped out of the verbal realm and isn't creating the structure anymore. There, it's narrowing down its focus into the present moment, what we call the present moment. And so now we're just sitting with that, much simpler. And then what I'm describing is something even more simple, which is that because the body is a construction, And of course, there's a story that goes along with it. But just to say, you know, the body is this construction, and to try to get down to the experience of the body that's not associated with a particular sense or a particular perception, but just a raw, again, pre-verbal experience. So now we're getting, again, kind of back, even further back into evolution. So this is like the, you know, the amoeba. That's just like, you know, we talk about the Vedana, the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. The amoeba is like drawn to things that can eat or mate with. I don't know if amoebas can do that, but anyway, let's just, you know, give me a little, you know, thrust here to get at like this primal level, which is just a going toward or going away or being still. And so now we're just in touch with this very raw level of life experience that's not even an animal, right? It's just the initial stage of life. And that though is tied up with the nervous system and a capacity to feel. But then there's something else, which is the more and more subtle thing, which is the awareness that knows the pleasant, the unpleasant, the neutral. And everything, all of our experience builds out of the awareness. Without the awareness, there's no feeling, there's no liking, there's no thinking. You know, it has to, that's kind of the baseline the baseline of consciousness is sort of redundant, but the baseline of our experience and of what we are. And so this is what I think Ajahn Amaro is trying to get us back to. So one more time, I'm going to read that sentence. This process opens us up to that spaciousness, which is beyond the feeling. And so what he's also talking about is that when we are focused on a particular feeling, well, I'm interpreting this. I'm not sure this is exactly what he's talking about, but what comes to my mind is that when we're focused on a particular feeling, there is also the identity tied into that. I am feeling that. And so the spaciousness is kind of dropping that as well, and not sort of limiting the boundaries of what we are experiencing. So that's kind of maybe a little further than I'm able to skillfully express, but something worth reflecting on. And the main thing, I mean, besides this practice of just being with feeling, the other thing that I am trying to get at is just this idea of going to a simpler and simpler kind of object to pay attention to. So, you know, the breath is a pretty simple object, but to go to this subtler and subtler level until it's like there's no thing there anymore, there's just space. Yeah. So there you go. That was fun for me anyway. Any questions or reflections or, you know, yeah, anything anybody would like to say? Ooh. Oh, wow, you found Silent Rain. Good job there, Angela. Okay, that was awesome. Thank you. 4 stars on Rotten Tomatoes. No, wait, Rotten Tomatoes doesn't have stars. And we've got the day long for tomorrow if you want to come to that. remotely or drive up to Lake County. It's actually really beautiful up here. Anybody, nobody, I don't see any raised hands or anything. How about a voice in the wilderness? Anne, hello, yay. I was kind of,
I thought I'd help you out there.
You knew I was sort of thinking of you when I was going into that talk.
Yeah, and I have no idea what I'm going to say. Except this is the kind of the practice I'm doing, attempting anyway to delve a little deeper into, is to pay more attention to the knowing rather than the object. And I really was only able to understand it on a retreat. And this, just me to the last retreat I was on last month, and to learn, get more instruction around it. All I can say is that my experience continues to be. That it's like the most freeing practice I've experienced so far. It's like, it's another portal. It's another doorway into letting go.
Yeah.
Non-clinging. Like, yeah. So with emotion, yeah. Something that I'm going to look a little deeper into now. But I hadn't really focused. I mean, I think I do that naturally, but and I just might look at it a little more deeply now, like difficult fears, for example.
Yeah.
So thank you. That was awesome. I must confess, I ordered the book. while you were talking.
Oh, good. I mean, I think it's an important point that you need a fair amount of concentration to be able to get to that level of clarity where you can, really of subtlety of awareness, to be able to pick up, the awareness itself, the knowing, as you said. It's that odd thing, which is that it's always there, but we're, because our focus is outward and materialistic in the sense that, if I'm going to be aware inwardly, I'm looking for some object, some thing to pay attention to. And awareness isn't a thing. Knowing isn't a thing. And so it's pretty tricky to say, I'm going to turn and be aware of that. It pretty much requires that everything else has to fall away in a sense. It's not easy to pick it out of the crowd, of the thoughts, feelings.
Too much noise. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But that's why a retreat, like when everything else quiets down, because it's always there, I mean, even if there is no sound and you're not seeing anything, your senses aren't operating, awareness, if you are awake, awareness is there, knowing is there. And so its function, it's not really interested. It doesn't have an ordinary function to pay attention to. That is, our senses have a function for us. We're looking at things because we need to see. We're listening to things because we need to hear. We're tasting things. All of those have functions that we draw upon. Whereas awareness just doesn't have the same kind of function or functional role in our lives. It's just there, and everything else sort of operates out of that. I know that, I mean, as I'm saying that, I'm like, well, that doesn't make sense, because of course it has a function. It has the function of letting you know things, but you know, it doesn't have like it doesn't have a standalone function, right? It has, its function is to let all the other senses, the six senses operate and, you know, bring in data and process data. But if all those other senses are taken away, the awareness itself doesn't have any function. It's just sitting there. It's like, to look at that, to find that, because our typical way of meditating and indeed using our awareness is we're always paying attention to an object. You know, seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, thinking. There's an object, a thing that we're paying attention to. You know, when you notice you're having a thought, that thought is a thing in your mind. But awareness isn't a thing in that same way. It isn't an object in itself. So if we haven't given everybody a headache, you know, well, perhaps.
It's like, okay, so I try to explain it to my friend, like certain friends that might get it, you know, they may not be meditators, but they might. So I'll like, if there's some kind of gong around, I have to change the settings. But if you hit a gong and you're usually like, okay, pay attention to the sound, listen to the sound of the gong, right? And then you hit it again and like, now turn toward the knowing of the sound. And people who, they're like, one friend of mine went, whoa, just by the thinking of it. Like, just, you know, maybe some people out, you know, here in here will get that, you know. It's a little easier to do with sounds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, sound is a great doorway into this. And it's interesting because what I thought you were going to say is listen to the gong. And when it's gone, notice what's there.
Oh, well, that too.
That seemed like a fun way to think of it. Like, just keep listening and listening. Okay, now what are you hearing?
Yeah, that's a fun exercise, yeah. For sure.
But yeah, that the sound is a really good way to get at this, because sound, you know, has a spacious quality, which is, you know, the feeling that is beyond, what does he say? I can't remember, somebody, you guys probably remember, the spaciousness which is beyond feeling. So sound is a great entryway into awareness of space and spaciousness. Yeah. Well, thanks for that little conversation.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you spoke up, because I was when I got to that, I was like, okay, now we're going into the LEAP program. So for those who don't know what that is, it's a program Spirit Rock has that Anne is part of, and which is, yeah, it's about working at, this book is looking at emptiness and knowing, what else?
Emptiness, liberation.
Liberation,
awareness, yeah. Emptiness, knowing, conscious. Yeah, we have a lot of definition. We got a lot of definitions on the first, on awareness, yeah. And consciousness and knowing.
Yeah. Okay, fun. So, yeah, if you can make it to any part of the day tomorrow, be happy to have you guys here. There will be actual humans in this space. Out here in Kelseyville. Yeah, I'm going to go 10 to 5 Pacific time, and should be fun. So otherwise, I'll be back on Tuesday. So thank you all.